Facebook, Twitter, Pinterest, email, Google+, simple ways that you can share Issues Etc. programs with your friends, relatives, and fellow parishioners. Just go to Listen on Demand Archives at issuesetc.org and look for the share feature images posted beneath each audio segment. You're only one click away from telling someone about Issues Etc. The Listen on Demand page at issuesetc.org and look for Share This.
You can call it what you like. I call it life. I call it life.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. The Washington Post has a headline here under Opinions, how a new generation of activists is trying to make abortion normal. Now, I think it's probably at least admitted now by all pro-abortion activists that there was a generation that didn't like the word abortion. They avoided the word abortion. Their slogans, they self-identified not by the term abortion, even though it was always there in the background. It was choice. It was women's reproductive health. It was all sorts of very clumsy ways of talking about or not talking about what they were in favor of. But the next generation, the new generation of advocates for abortion, are not afraid of the word, and they're not afraid of the idea, and many of them are out and proud with their abortions. What has changed? We'll answer that question. Michael Spencer joins us on this Wednesday afternoon, June the 17th. He's Midwest Director of Training for Life Training Institute. Michael, welcome back.
Thank you, Todd. Good to be back.
Why did the old guard of abortion advocates, while they were extremely vocal and active, and have been for 40 years, why did they avoid the word abortion?
Well, Todd, certainly they hid the word abortion behind euphemisms like, as you mentioned, product of conception, parasite, massive unwanted cells. And they did this because they had to do it in order to dehumanize the unborn child to justify abortion. The other reason they did it is because it worked. It was easy to do it back then. But we have had, because pro-lifers have done an admirable job of exposing the fruitless deed of darkness, that being abortion, and because we have had such advances in ultrasound technology in recent years, we now have a window to the womb, and these euphemisms don't work anymore. And so that's why they have come out swinging and using the word abortion somewhat unapologetically, in fact, shamelessly.
It's not just the use of the word, which I've noticed over the last probably 2 or 3 years is now being used without any nervous kind of twitching on the part of the advocates of abortion. They're comfortable with it. But there's also a kind of advocacy that isn't just, well, this is a necessary evil. It's a positive good. Talk about that, if you would, Michael.
Sure. Well, again, let's just keep in mind what they're attempting to normalize here. We're talking about the dismemberment, the decapitation, and the disemboweling of preborn children. And I think what's happening is here is we really are seeing the hardening of the heart in America regarding abortion, at least on the side of those who defend the abortion decision. You know, if you look back to 1973, the years leading up to that, and then for another 15 or 20 years after that, again, the argument was, well, it's not a baby, it's just a blob. And then it became, the argument shifted, and it became, okay, it is a baby, it's a human being, but it's not a person. And so there was this artificial distinction drawn between a human being and a person. And now we're seeing the continuation down this, the slide down this hill here, where now it's, okay, it's a baby, it's a human, it's a person, but so what? The mother's rights trump the baby's rights. I think what we're really seeing here is really what Jesus predicted, that there's a hardening of the heart. And so I think there's a brazenness about this because in some ways I think they have been forced into this. We have smoked them out of their holes, so to speak, because the pro-life movement is, I think, becoming more effective. It's becoming more effective in its ability to present the case for life in a way that is gracious and in a way that is compelling. And I think that's kind of put them in a position where they have nowhere else to go.
Okay, so in a way that I don't want to paint the pro-life position here as kind of victims of their own success. I agree with you completely that, and at least rhetorically, left the pro-abortion advocates with no place to stand except right on that word, abortion, and they're doing their best trying to do it. Are they still, in subtle ways, however, denying what is the essence of the question here, and that is, who is the unborn?
Oh, absolutely. Lucy Flores in this article, and certainly others, Elise Hoag and Cecile Richards, and you know, others, they are ignoring this. And if you look at most, almost all pro-choice rhetoric ignores the nature of the unborn child. And so even in using the word abortion, they're talking about it being something good for women, and they're talking about this being a you know, the positive abortion story. Or in this article, in fact, Todd, it refers to abortion as the good abortion or the best decision. One referred to it as the best decision of my life. One couple referred to in the article suggested that their abortion actually strengthened their relationship. They talk about putting a human face on abortion. All of this, again, is an intention here to normalize this. And yet, in so doing, they continue to ignore the unborn child. Abortion, even if it could be argued that it was good for women, which it can't be argued that way, but even if it could be argued that some women do find relief from their abortions, which I think in some cases is true, it doesn't deal with the ethical question of, is abortion moral or not? It ignores that question. It ignores the nature of the unborn child.
And it ignores, I think you would agree, this, something that stands alongside, the nature of the unborn child stands alongside and cannot be separated from the intrinsic value of that life. What it sounds to me, that this hard-heartedness, this cold-heartedness, is essentially a denial of the intrinsic value, not of just the unborn, the life of the unborn, but ultimately the logic can't bear the weight of this. It's going to have to deny the intrinsic value of any life, isn't it?
Well, that's exactly right. Because if we talk about the ontological nature of the unborn child, we know what that is. It's a distinct, living, and whole human being from the moment of conception. That's a settled scientific fact among human embryologists. But science, of course, can't speak to the value. It can tell us what something or someone is, but it can't speak to its value. And so we go to the philosophy question, which is simply, what is it that makes humans valuable? And you know, what gives us our valuable? Of course, as Christians, we believe that our value is rooted in the fact that we are created in the image of God, the Imago Dei. But even with non-Christians, even with atheists, we can find common ground, because even most atheists would acknowledge that human beings have some value, intrinsic value, perhaps. What we disagree with many atheists, or at least many pro-choicers, on is whether or not the unborn child is of that status, whether or not they are a full-fledged member of the human community.
Now, I mean, talk about that, because we used to discuss these things as kind of, well, it's the hypothetical future of the pro-choice or the pro-abortion movement, where they, if they were consistent, they would have to say, if a woman's rights trump the rights or the value of the child's life, then it would also follow that the woman's rights would trump the rights or the value of her toddler's life or her teenager's life. We're not that far from that, are we?
Well, no, not at all. I mean, that's really right where we're at. You know, we are a nation that really has lost its moral compass on this. We've thrown science out. It's interesting, because we are accused as pro-lifers and as Christians, we're accused all the time. I hear this on university campuses, that we're anti-science, you know. But the fact of the matter is we build our case on science as well as on philosophy. And both of those things are being thrown, because our case is so robust. It is so compelling. It is so strong and so convincing that the other side really, again, is left with having to spin this and talk about abortion spas and the positive abortion story, and they're having to spin it because they're left with nothing else.
So, what are they trying to say to women who have, in many cases, been pressured to undergo an abortion, and it hasn't been the best decision of their life? They wake up at night realizing it was one of the worst decisions of their life. What are they saying to her?
Well, in this article here that you referred to at the outset, it talks about the fact that Renee Bracey Sherman of NARAL actually felt the need, apparently, to write a guide to abortion sharing, which I think is really telling. The fact that women need to be coaxed to share their story. If the abortion experience is so good and so positive, why do women need to be coaxed to share this story? They're wanting these women to come out and talk about how positive this is. Again, though, what they're ignoring here is, even if the experience were positive for all women having abortions, which obviously it is not, but even if it were, It's ignoring the ethical question here of whether or not it is right, ever right, to unjustly take the life of an innocent human being, which is exactly what abortion does.
So how do we make that case? You've talked about it, making the case compassionately and convincingly. How do we do that to both of these wings here, of the woman who said, I had to, and I support the right of a woman to have an abortion because I had to, and the woman who said, I did it, and it was the best experience of my life?
Well, again, as you said, we always want to be compassionate. Certainly, real people are hurt by abortion, not just the unborn child, but the women who have them, the men who in many cases didn't have a say or maybe did have a say and regretted their decision. So we always want to be compassionate. But we want to always bring this back to the central question, and that is, what are the unborn? And again, the science of human embryology has answered this for us. They are distinct, living, and whole human beings. And so we have to stay focused on that question like a laser beam. What are they? The second thing that we have to do is not only establish the humanity of the unborn child through the science of human embryology, but we also have to establish the value of the unborn child through the question, what is it that makes humans valuable? And that's where even when we're talking to, say, someone who doesn't have a Christian worldview, we can appeal to the fact that we share a common human nature as human beings. And that nature doesn't change from the moment you're conceived in the womb until the moment that you're born or until the moment you die at 75 or 85 years old. While we change functionally and we change in our level of IQ, we change in our appearance, we change in our location, we do not change in our nature. Our nature or our identity remains the same. And so that's common ground that we can build on. Now, I'm not saying that it's always easy, because sometimes people are irrational. Sometimes they come to the table very emotionally, and they don't see the value of these arguments. But we need to persist there, and we need to stay focused there, because that's really where we're going to win. And when I say win, let me define the term there. That's where we're going to be effective in persuading. Again, I'm not suggesting that everybody's going to be persuaded by those arguments. I think the arguments are very robust. I think they're very good, but not everybody is going to be persuaded because, frankly, some people cannot see the forest for the trees. They're so ideologically glued to their position that they're not going to see that. But that's where we need to build our house.
Do you think that the abortion industry, and we do have to speak about it as an industry, in both financially in terms of its organization, do you think they're slower to come to this because, of course, they're a business and they're cautious about such things, but do you think that they are going to try to jump on the bandwagon of let's just talk openly about abortion, about how great it can be?
Well, I'm guessing that the industry itself, they've got a lot at stake here, millions and millions of dollars. I think they're going to lick their finger and stick it up into the wind and see which way the winds are blowing. If they see this gaining traction, meaning that this new approach starts to have some rhetorical power, I think they'll definitely jump on it. I think they're going to sit back for a while and wait to see where that goes. I'm guessing it's not going to be very successful for them, because keep in mind, when they speak out and say, this is normal, come to the spa and have your abortion, the pro-life movement's going to be right there saying, okay, take a look. This is what abortion does to little boys and girls. It decapitates them. It disembowels them. This is the harsh, brutal reality of abortion. And we're going to be right there with that message. And I don't know how they can overcome that with any amount of words.
What about our politicians? Do you think, there have been a few attempts. The Washington Post actually begins its story with an attempt on the part of a prospective politician to attempt openness about her abortion and casting it in a positive light.
Yeah. Well, and we saw where that went. Lucy Flores, who you're referring to, I believe lost that lieutenant governorship to, I think it was Mark Hutchinson, and I think she lost it by 20-something. In fact, I think the article says it was 26 points, that she lost that on. Now, again, there were other factors playing into that, so I'm not prepared to say that it was all over this. Yeah, I think politicians are going to take a look at this on both sides of the issue, and what effect it's going to have, I guess, will remain to be seen. But we just need, again, in the pro-life community, we need to keep the pressure on our politicians and help them see what abortion does to little boys and girls. I keep coming back to that because that's the issue here. Abortion unjustly ends the life of an innocent human being, and that story, that message needs to be told.
So does anything change, even though the rhetoric on the other side changes and will continue to change? They're going to try this and that. Does anything change? Not, and here we're not talking about rhetoric, but we're talking about solid arguments and the facts that are on the side of those advocating for the unborn.
No, I really don't think anything does change. Our argument is a good, solid argument, and it has nothing to do with how they spin their side. Now, how we respond to that, you know, tactically, certainly we're going to, you know, from conversation to conversation, you know, we're going to approach that differently. But I think our argument stays the same because our argument is rooted in the truth. It's rooted in the nature of the unborn child and the intrinsic value of every human being. It is a position of human equality, and we don't need to alter that. To meet them at the table on this.
Michael Spencer is Midwest Director of Training for Life Training Institute. You'll find a link to Life Training Institute at our website, issuesetc.org. Click Listen on Demand. Keep up the good work, Michael. Thank you very much for being our guest.
Thank you, Todd.
Tomorrow on Issues Etc., we're going to get a review of the movie Jurassic World. Pastor Ted Giese will be our guest. We'll have Dr. James Hitchcock join us to answer the question, is Pope Francis a communist? He's been accused of a lot of things. We'll answer that one on tomorrow's Issues, Etc. We'll also discuss Christ in Job chapter 38. Pastor Brian Ketchelmeyer will be our guest. One of the things that your young men, your young women, college age, university age, will inevitably encounter at the secular university and college is this new rhetoric about abortion. There will be people there who will be advocating for abortion as a positive good. There will be people there who will be urging young people not only to embrace it philosophically, but to go out and have one. They will be using the language openly. Your kids might find it refreshing or shocking or whatever it may be, but they will encounter it. It's one of the things that LCMSU is concerned about for your children and for you as well, to connect your kids to strong confessionally Lutheran resources, pastors, and congregations is one of the things we can do to help our young people in the college and the university think straight about these issues, get their heads on straight when someone's trying to twist it around. Find out more about LCMSU, lcmsu.org/LCMSU. That's lcms.org/LCMSU. They're going to change their rhetoric because they're fighting a losing battle against truth. They really are. A movement that is based upon a lie, or really built upon a stack of lies about who the unborn are, has to constantly change its language. Back up, try again. Those who defend the unborn, we have the facts and the truth on our side. I'm Todd Wilkin. I'll talk with you tomorrow. Thanks for listening to Issues Etc.
Listen weekday afternoons to Pastor Todd Wilkin and guests on Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is vital for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our mailing address, Issues Etc., P.O. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. You can also donate at our website, issuesetc.org. Issues Etc. is a production of LPR, Lutheran Public Radio.
The third commandment teaches us to remember the Sabbath day by keeping it holy. We do this when we hold God's word sacred and gladly hear and learn it. Jesus invites the weak and heavy laden to rest in him, our true rest, because his yoke is easy and his burden is light. This weekend, rest in Jesus as you hear his word and receive his gifts. If you are in Southern Illinois, you're invited to join Trinity Lutheran Church in Millstadt to rest in the grace of our Savior, Jesus Christ. Learn more at trinitymillstadt.org.
Salvation by grace through faith, the Christological meaning of marriage, the resplendent armor of God. These are some of the themes that you'll find in the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for June, the New Concordia Commentary on Ephesians. It's published by Concordia Publishing House. Their phone number, 1-800-325-3040, or you can read an excerpt of the Concordia Commentary on Ephesians at issuesetc.org, the Issues Etc. Book of the Month, the Concordia Commentary on Ephesians.